And in order to be virtuous, or the best source of virtue, they believed, was the Bible, traditional or historic teachings of Christianity. And if those teachings of Christianity could help people sacrifice their own interests for the greater good of the Republic, then the Founding Fathers were interested in that.
Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing program to our world-renowned theologians, we prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
Let's start by you giving us your name and your title and your unique academic background as it relates to America's history.
Sure. My name is John Fia. I teach American history at Messiah College, a little Christian liberal arts college outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I'm the chair of the history department there. I've written 5 books on American history, mostly early American and American religious history. I'm a prolific blogger. I like to think of myself as prolific at The Way of Improvement Leads Home. We get about 3,000-4,000 readers a day on that blog. So with teaching, writing, I keep myself busy.
And let's talk about Improvement Leads Home. What Sure. is the blog all about?
It is a blog that sort of discusses issues at the intersection of religion, politics, academic life, and American history. So we do a lot of things. We're doing posts about the way history sort of informs current events. So when people refer to the Founding Fathers, say in a political speech, we're there to check, to make sure that the history is being done right. My favorite quote comes from the African American historian John Hope Franklin, who said that historians are the conscience of the nation. Mm-hmm. So I take that seriously, right? We do a lot of fact checking, a lot of sort of thinking about historical dimensions of contemporary life.
Let's dive right in.
Sure.
Was America founded as a Christian nation is the title of one of your books.
That's
and it's
right.
the question that has been on countless media programs.
Sure.
How do you answer?
Well, it's a tough question to answer. And part of the strength of the book is that I don't try to settle for easy yes and no answers. I really approach that book as a historian rather than as a politician, because it's very easy to manipulate the past to make it fit into your own contemporary or present day agenda. So as a historian, I want to try to lay aside the best I can any kind of political agenda I might have, and just kind of see what the founders believed about the relationship between religion and the republic that they were trying to build. So it's hard to answer yes or no, and in some ways it's actually a pretty bad historical title, because it's taking a contemporary debate, was America founded as a Christian nation, and sort of superimposing that upon 18th century men who may not have been asking that question in the same way.
So maybe I should reshape the question.
Sure.
Was there a spiritual motivation? Mm-hmm. Was there a Christian freedom cause
Sure.
that led to the inception of the United States of America?
Well, there's different ways of answering that question. Certainly the Founding Fathers believed in religious liberty. They believed that all human beings, as a result of the fact that they were perhaps even created in the image of God, had dignity, worth, and thus should have liberty of conscience. What the founders did believe, too, was that in order for a republic to work, remember, these were not theologians, these were not pastors, right? These were politicians, statesmen, lawyers, but they all had a common belief from their study of history, especially the Greeks and the Romans, that republics only worked when people were virtuous. And in order to be virtuous, or the best source of virtue, they believed, was the Bible, traditional or historic teachings of Christianity. And if those teachings of Christianity could help people sacrifice their own interests for the greater good of the Republic, then the Founding Fathers were interested in that. So I think there is this, the Founding Fathers did see the importance of religion. Many of the secular critics of my work are often criticizing me for giving too much credit to the religious motivations of the Founding Fathers. On the other hand, I'm often skeptical of other forms of history that are done by Christians who want to claim that the Founding Fathers were all born again or were all, you know, trying to create a distinctly Christian nation. I think sometimes Christians err on that side as well. So I often get attacked by conservative Christians who don't like the fact that I'm suggesting that, you know, other ideas like the Enlightenment and these kinds of things also worked alongside of Christianity. So I would hesitate to say that Christianity was the sole, you know, motivator for the American Revolution and for the building of the Republic, but it certainly played a role.
The religion chair at Boston University talks about religious literacy in colonial America.
Sure.
That the pastors had the intellect and the doctrinal knowledge to imbue the fathers of the Republic that consequently gave us this distinction biblically that we see reflected on Washington landmarks, sure, etc. How do you interpret his interpretation of colonial America?
Yeah, I'm assuming you're referring to Stephen Prothero's book on religious literacy. And, you know, much of that book is very accurate. I mean, it's a very, very good piece. And simply because what one needs to realize is the 18th century world is very different than the world of the 21st century. One of the things I love to tell my students is that the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there, right? So in many ways, a local clergyman, a local minister, would not only have been there to care for the souls of the people in his congregation and in his community, but as an educated person, and perhaps in most small towns in colonial America, the only educated person in the community. This person was responsible for education. Usually the minister ran a school, and at the heart of education, especially in 17th century New England, the Puritans and Massachusetts Bay and Plymouth and these places, the Bible was the centerpiece of that education. So ministers would have been clearly involved in sort of, you know, bringing biblical literacy to the colonies. And to the extent that, you know, some of the Founding Fathers came out of this sort of New England tradition, people like John Adams, Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and others, they would have imbibed this. Even Ben Franklin, who later became a little bit of a skeptic, but was raised in a New England household in Boston. His father was a good Puritan. His father wanted him to become a minister. We need to be careful of sort of superimposing that on all the colonies. If you go down into the Virginia, where you have a much, much different kind of religious life, you still have the centrality of the Anglican minister. But Anglicanism is a very different kind of animal than the Calvinism of New England. So you do have people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who would have been, certainly biblically literate, certainly would have thought about ways to apply their biblical faith to public policy or the building of the Republic, but might have approached it in a little less kind of, maybe if we take a 21st century term, a little less evangelical kind of way than perhaps someone like John Witherspoon, the president of the College of New Jersey, or Samuel Adams, who, you know, Witherspoon and Adams are people that probably would be comfortable in a kind of evangelical church today. But not all the Founding Fathers would have been.
Does this history in a combined way make America predisposed uniquely to a spiritual and even a Christian predisposition, unlike the beginnings of other nations on planet Earth?
Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to take that kind of argument about American exceptionalism. So, you know, as a Christian thing, I think America is very much an exceptional nation, in the sense that it's the first nation built on the idea of human rights. You could say it's the first nation built upon the idea that those rights come from God. At least that's how they articulate that. But this would not have been a unique thing in the 18th century. In fact, the idea that all humans are created in the image of God, or that our rights come from our Creator, were very sort of British ideas, English ideas, that the colonists, who of course had been British for 150 years, sort of imbibed. So it's hard to say that the emphasis on the Bible and the Creator and the spiritual commitments of the founding fathers necessarily made them unique and exceptional in the Western world. Virtually every nation in the Western world, from Russia to Spain, to France, to England, would have believed that somehow the monarch was in charge of preserving, cultivating, strengthening a Christian nation. It's just a matter of how you define a Christian nation. It is unique that the Americans try to build a republic out of a very strong Christian, maybe Protestant, kind of culture. They come out of this with a republic, while other countries come out of this with a monarch. So that does make them unique.
Let's talk about the signatories on the Declaration of Independence. Sure. We've been, often told that many of them were clerics or they were oriented to Christianity. Mm-hmm. How many were there? How many are part of that camp?
There's a common misperception, which I often hear from certain sectors of the Christian right, so to speak, that large numbers of the founding fathers were ministers. That's just simply not true. There was one practicing minister who signed the Declaration of Independence. I mentioned him a few minutes ago, John Witherspoon, the president of the College of New Jersey, who was a Presbyterian minister. Now, if you want to sort of expand that definition of what a minister is to someone who may have taken a course in the Bible or in theology or in moral philosophy, Christian moral philosophy, which would have been the word for ethics back then, then certainly any of the founding fathers who went through one of the major colleges, Harvard, Yale, the College of New Jersey at Princeton, William and Mary, King's College in New York, Queens College in New Brunswick, New Jersey, King's would eventually become Columbia, Queens, Rutgers, would have taken courses in these fields, but that doesn't necessarily mean they go on to become ordained clergy. So that would be the equivalent of someone who attends sort of a Christian college today, who is required to take 6 hours of Bible or 6 hours of theology, saying that they're a minister. So it's hard to, there were no ministers. Now, were there people who were kind of orthodox believers, laymen who were orthodox believers? Absolutely. And there you have people like Sam Adams, Patrick Henry, obviously Witherspoon, John Jay, the first Supreme Court justice. I think it's safe to say that all of these men would have fallen within the camp of Orthodox Christianity, maybe even evangelical Protestant Christianity. But then there are others, of course, who are much more skeptical, people like Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. George Washington is very difficult to figure out. He was a good Virginia Anglican. And, sometimes for many evangelicals today who want to claim him, he's hard to claim in that sense. On the other hand, he knew his Bible well. He claimed he was a Christian. So it's very complicated. I tell my students all the time, when you're talking about the religion of the founding fathers, let's not put them all under that umbrella term, because they're, the founding fathers believed, right? We know that they believe certain things because they all signed the Declaration of Independence or they all signed the Constitution. But when it comes to religion, they're a very, very diverse bunch.
The work of David Barton has had immense controversy surrounding it. He paints a picture of America like it's all Bible quoting, Jesus loving, solidarity. Early pioneers. Do you agree or disagree?
David Barton, I've been a strong critic of David Barton. I should say this in a positive sense about David Barton. David Barton has called our attention to the fact that religion has played a vital role in early American history, that the Bible was important, that the founding fathers were aware of the scriptures, they were aware of Christianity, and they actually thought it was useful in building a republic. I think the problem with David Barton, and the reason why I critique him so strongly in some of my work, especially on my blog, is that David Barton goes into the past with a political agenda, and he only sees one side of the story. So for David Barton, if if there is a part of 18th century history of the founding that does not necessarily fit very well into the political agenda that he has in the 21st century as an activist within the Republican Party, he has no use for that history. I'm a Christian. I'm also a historian. David Barton is a Christian. He is someone who works in the past as well. Notice I hesitated to call him a historian. But I think the difference between the way he approaches the past and, say, someone like me approaches the past, or other evangelical historians who I think you've maybe even interviewed for this documentary, is the fact that as a Christian and a historian, we're wanting to pursue the truth wherever it leads. And we want to have integrity when we do that, and not just cherry pick what's useful and what's not useful, and then try to convince people to buy into whatever our political agenda is. And for some, that political agenda may be a very good political agenda. All the critics of Barton, I think, are saying that, are Christian critics, are let's not manipulate American history to get there. Right? I mean, if you have certain convictions about the way America should be, especially on the moral front or the social issues, don't try to pigeonhole the founders, you know, if they're not pigeonholable, if that's a word, into your agenda. So I don't have a whole lot of respect for David Barton as a historian. But I think he has created this narrative. He controls the narrative for whatever reason, whether it's the funding that he has, whether it's the ability to win people over with his lectures and so forth. Now, David Barton also gets a lot of his facts wrong. But that's not the primary reason why I'm a critic of him. You know, I'm a critic of him because of the way he uses the past in a manipulative way. The past was never meant to, you know, justify some kind of political cause.
Is it a revisionist history that basically is fuel to the religious right?
Absolutely. I mean, we're any good historian is a revisionist, right? I mean, now in some circles, that's a bad word. Usually when people use revisionist history, they're normally suggesting something to the effect of it's bad history, or it's biased history, or you're manipulating the facts to serve some agenda. In some ways, all good historians are revisionists because they're always open to changing the interpretation of the past when new evidence arises, or, you know, you find a new document or something and you may have to adjust and change. David Barton is doing a kind of revisionism, though, that I think is dangerous, simply because he's not looking at the fullness of the past. He likes to accuse people who don't look at history the same way he does as revisionists, and he uses that term in a very negative kind of way. I tend to look at him as more of a revisionist. When you think about the vast community of early American historians, not just the kind of secular pagans that he likes to talk about who teach at secular universities, but I know of virtually no Christian college in the country. And we're talking about schools now with history departments that are from very conservative schools, Bob Jones University, Liberty University, these kinds of places, where the history department there accepts David Barton's view of history. He's kind of been forced into this island of some small, inconsequential little Bible colleges and so forth. But that's, in some ways, that's unimportant because he has the people behind him. He's managed to sway people over to his narrative. And that's a narrative that, frankly, I've spent a better part of my career trying to, as a Christian, as an evangelical Christian, as I would identify myself that way, trying to counter.
We discredit ourselves when we misinterpret history, don't we?
I think so. I think it's an issue. You know, if there's one kind of dimension of integrity that any historian has, it's to try to understand the past in all its fullness, its complexity, and tell an honest story about it. Even if that honest story does not necessarily get us where we want to go in 2016. Mm. So that's how I approach my work as a professional historian.
Now, the religion chair at Boston has also talked about how the scripture was a primer for the New England colony. Mm-hmm. And so you have written The Bible Cause,
yeah,
a history of the American Bible Society. What drew your attention to that book? Why the American Bible Society in particular?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. The American Bible Society approached me as their 200th anniversary was coming up. The American Bible Society was founded in 1816. We're filming this in 2016, so they're just coming to the end of their 200th anniversary, bicentennial year. They approached me about writing a history of the American Bible Society, but they wanted a sort of coffee table kind of very kind of pro, you know, kind of, we call it hagiography, in you know, kind of something that's going to be a cheerleading kind of book. Look how God used the American Bible Society. And I'm sympathetic to the American Bible Society's mission, and I think God has used that. But that's not the kind of history I write. I'm an academic historian. So I came back to them and said, you know, I'll do the 200th history if you give me complete academic freedom to write the way I want to write. I'm going to tell, you know, I don't know if there's any skeletons in the closet. I found out there weren't many. But if I do find skeletons, I need to tell. Mm-hmm. I need to tell that. I mean, we're all sinners to some extent, right? You know, it wouldn't surprise me if I found that. And give me the opportunity to go find a publisher for the book. It was a risky move, I think, by the American Bible Society. I think they knew I was sympathetic to the American Bible Society and their mission, but you know, they didn't know what I was going to write. So I had complete freedom to tell the story the way I wanted to, and I thought it was just a wonderful case study to look at an institution that has been such a fixture in American life, and then tell the story of the Bible in America through the window of that institution. So in some ways, this is not only a history of the sort of nuts and bolts details, you know, they did this, then they did this, and they moved to this building, but it also sort of connects the mission of the American Bible Society with the story of the United States. And what's fascinating is the American Bible Society is present at almost every major moment in American history, from the time that they were founded all the way up to the present.
I was really taken with the pictures in the book.
Yeah.
And I mean, can you tell us how central the scriptures were in the 18th, 19th century?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Bible was the most important book in America. It was the best-selling book in America. The American Bible Society knew that. And their goal was to try to get this book, which they believe would not only transform individual lives, prepare people for eternity, help them to live lives pleasing to God, but they also believed that this book was central to the mission of the United States as a moral, godly people. So if there ever was a time in which there was an organization that sort of promoted the idea that we should be a biblical nation, a godly nation, even a Christian nation, it was the American Bible Society. So as I say it in the book, the American Bible Society, I call them not only the American Bible Society, but they were also the American Bible Society, because they were very much tied into sort of American ideas of nationalism and American greatness, American exceptionalism, because America was founded on the Bible. So absolutely, one of my favorite stories in the book comes in the late 1820s. The society had only been in operation for about 13 years, and they went out on this ambitious, or created this ambitious, somewhat bold plan to provide a Bible for every American family in the United States and do it in 2 years. So that was such a fun chapter to write, because, you know, I have, the records are just unbelievably complete for this area. So I could literally unpack, you know, the secretary, Charles Brigham, sort of sitting in the nerve center in New York with maps on the wall saying, we got the Bible up to Northern Alabama now. We're still missing it here in this part of South Carolina, or we need to, you know, get up into Upper New Hampshire. And it was just an amazing, you know, that kind of thing would never happen today. And now they failed. They just barely missed the deadline to get a Bible to every American family. But the very fact that something like that would be tried, you know, in the early 19th century tells you that it was a very kind of biblically saturated culture. And there was no opposition to this, as far as I can, you know, could you imagine today if someone tried to propose to put a Bible, the ACLU and, you know, every kind of, you know, separation of church and state group and everything would be all over them. So that was a fascinating part of it.
How did the, so take us through the 19th into the 20th century with the American Bible Society.
Sure.
What was the trajectory?
Yeah, the American Bible Society, after the Civil War, they're very active in distributing Bibles during the Civil War through an organization known as the U.S. Christian Commission, which handled a lot of the ministries for the Union during the Civil War. After the Civil War, they were very active in Reconstruction, trying to bring in the North and South back together after the war. They worked very closely in providing Bibles to the Freedmen's Bureau and to African Americans, the freemen, the former slaves. So they were involved in bringing the Bible into schools for African Americans, former slaves. It was also around the middle of the 19th century that the American Bible Society began expanding beyond the bounds of the United States. They moved into present-day Turkey, what was then known as the Levant region, the Middle East, Mexico, China. So by the turn of the 20th century, well, really by World War I, the American Bible Society was in almost every continent on the planet, bringing Bibles, usually through native Chinese, Mexican coal porters, who are Bible peddlers, Bible sellers. What's fascinating is the American Bible Society was a business, so they were always interested in selling the Bibles rather than giving them away for free, like say the Gideons do today or something like that. And the reason why was they had a reason for this, and it was, if you can get somebody to give their hard-earned money, someone who's poor, say, to give their hard-earned money to purchase a Bible, they would be more likely to read it, think about it, care for it, as opposed to if you gave them away for free. So in China, you know, they were giving them away for free, and a lot of the Chinese people were tearing up the pages and stuffing them in their heels of their shoes to get a better lift, and that was a problematic thing, obviously, for the American Bible Society. So they really, in those years, late 19th century into the 20th century, really all the way up even to World War II, the sort of global outreach of this organization really sort of kicks in.
Now, we have this reality that the Bible cannot be taught in U.S. public schools. Mm-hmm. I was in Israel last week where the Bible is taught to Israeli students. And in fact, evolution is forbidden to be taught in Israel. Mm-hmm. Any prospect about the Bible being taught in the United States?
Well, let me connect this to the story of the American Bible Society again as a historian here. You know, the pivotal Supreme Court case, well, there were two, right? One was related to prayer, right? 1963, Engel v. Vital, prayers out of public schools, and then following that, Abington v. Shemp in 1964. What's fascinating about the American Bible Society's approach to Abington v. Shemp was that the American Bible Society actually supported Abington v. Shemp, and the reason they supported it was that they saw this as an opportunity to develop curriculum about the Bible that could be used in a kind of more objective way as a textbook in public schools. So they realized, look, we're not going to win the battle of having devotional Bible reading in schools. Those days are over. So they took a very practical approach, I should say, to that. You know, those days are over. But if you read the decision in Abington v. Shemp, it does allow, and I'm blanking right now on the name of the justice who wrote this part of the decision. It does allow, it does not condemn the use of the Bible, I should say, in public schools. It can be used as a textbook in a sort of non-doctrinal or sort of non-kind of preaching kind of way. And the American Bible Society seized the day on this. They saw this as an opportunity to get the Bible into schools at a much greater level than they had been even before, and use the Bible as a textbook. Now, you know, it gets interesting. You know, some of the internal letters that I've been exposed to in the archives, you know, there's kind of a wink wink here, right? You know, the American Bible Society also has a mission, right? So, you know, they play by the rules, but there's also this kind of sense, well, if we get the Bible in there, you know, let the Spirit work, maybe something will happen, right? You know, but clearly in their public approach, they support Abington v. Shemp, and they support the the clause in there, especially because of the clause that allows the Bible to continue to be taught in a sort of objective way.
So do we have the Bible actually taught in public schools in the United States?
I mean, to this day, there's actually a professor at Southern Methodist University in Dallas named Mark Chancey, who's done an extensive study of Bible classes in public schools. And what he's found was, yes, the Bible is being taught in public schools, mostly in the South. It's not being taught very well. And when he says it's not being taught very well, he doesn't mean that the teachers don't understand it or they can't communicate it. Most of the way the Bible's being taught in public schools right now is overly partisan and devotional in a way that's probably unconstitutional, but yet it's being done. On the other hand, he also has called attention, I think, to public schools where there has been a push to have the Bible in public schools, but the school misunderstanding the Abington v. Shemp case will not allow it because they think it's some form of indoctrination. So there's the other side too. What Chancey, I think, wants to do, and what others who are, you know, Chancey's a Bible professor, he teaches the Bible. I think what many would like to see is the Bible there as a textbook to reflect, it's an important book that's been a major influence on the Western world and beyond, and the United States. It's something that, you know, it's hard to learn about the United States of America without understanding the Bible. I can't teach most of my general education survey classes of American history without bringing up the Bible. It saturates political language. I mean, probably the greatest inaugural address ever delivered by a president was Lincoln's second inaugural address, which references the Sermon on the Mount, the Psalms. I think those who would argue for the Bible in public schools would say you must have some, and this goes back to the BU professor Stephen Prothero that you mentioned. You have to have some kind of a biblical literacy in order to just understand our country's past. And if history is going to produce good citizens and we contribute to making good citizens, I should say, you need to have some kind of biblical literacy.
Regarding the landscape spiritually of today, yeah, we have a cohort of about 56 million adult Americans who've left the church. Mm-hmm. The recent report said 25% of adult Americans have left. Mm-hmm. 1 in 3 are millennials. Gallup said that the Bible was the most popular, least read book in America. Mm-hmm. How do you correlate what's happening right now?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is, and again, I'll speak as a historian, since, you know, I'm not a sort of, you know, expert, I'm not a sociologist or anything like that. But I think as a historian, what you're beginning to see, and you see this with the Obergefell Supreme Court case on marriage, you see this with a variety of different threats to religious liberty and so forth. Christian schools who are no longer able to, you know, are being challenged for their beliefs. I think what you're beginning to see is the decline of Christian America, or at least as one author has recently put it, the decline of white Christian America, because the African churches are still pretty vibrant, but they were never at the center of the Christian nation, if you will. So I think what's happening is you're seeing a decline in this Christian culture that has so dominated America, for good or for bad, that has so dominated America since the time of the American Revolution, really took off in the 19th century through benevolent organizations like the American Bible Society. And as you see the decline of this, I think the nuns, if you will, those who are not attending church, those who the Barna Group and others who I've identified as people who, you know, the generation that's where, you know, the church is losing, I think that's a reflection of of this decline, this historical trajectory that we're seeing. Again, I'm not in a position as a historian to say if that's a good or a bad thing. I have my opinions, but I can offer you suggestions just like anyone else would be able to offer you suggestions. But I think what you're seeing is Christians are going to have to come up with a new way to engage, whether it be politically, culturally, and so forth, because they no longer have a sort of Christian consensus backing them up or as a safety net. And in some ways, if this continues, if this kind of progressive march continues, I think, you know, Christians are going to have to actually look at history. They're going to have to think about maybe the first century, the second century, when they were a persecuted minority. They're going to have to think about examples of how the church made it through these times when they were not the dominant culture. So I think Christians are, especially evangelical Christians today, but Christians of all stripes, are sort of faced with a challenge today. I think we're at a point, a sort of turning point, where some new ways of thinking about this have to be developed. We need some creative thinking about it, rather than relying on sort of the old culture war playbook that has been around since the 1970s. So that's my take on it, at least.
One final question. Biblical illiteracy is at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. And so many of the Christian university professors have remarked that students entering classes have so little misinformed knowledge on the Bible.
Yeah.
Do you see the same thing? Yeah. And why is that? That the best-selling book has failed to penetrate the intellectual psyche of a millennial.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that. I wish I could. You know, I wish I could give something more, you know, definitive. I think there's a challenge here to the churches, and the way in which they are preparing. You know, it's not all the church's fault, but I mean, to what extent are especially evangelical churches, which prize the Bible perhaps more than any other group. I think it's very important. You know, the days of kind of, you know, memorizing the Bible, and I rarely hear about that anymore. You know, in Sunday school and the sword drills that we used to do when we were kids, right? The sword meaning the sort of right sword of the spirit. I think there needs to be a sort of biblical revival or a revival of biblical study within the church. Part of that, I think, is what the historian Mark Knoll has called the scandal of the evangelical mind. We are sort of very emotionally driven by things. We like our praise music and our worship. We like to feel good about our religion, but we're not really taking seriously the task to sharpen our minds with the Word of God, iron sharpen iron, studying the Bible. And then there needs to be a space, I think, within the evangelical church then to get the church to think deeply about how the Bible impacts every aspect of our culture and what a biblical response to X, Y, or Z issue is going to be. And that's what I worry about to some extent. I don't have any answers. You can ask the sociologists that. You can ask the people, you know. To me, anything after 1800 is current events. It's not history. but no, I mean, I'm just joking about that. But obviously, I've written about things beyond 1800. But yeah, I mean, I think as a historian, I can only offer so much to answer that question.
At HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.